Conference Forum meeting several months ago, and though I didn't hear it, I've heard wonderful things about it, so I think you're in for a treat this morning. Susan Staker is an editor at Signature Books, in addition to her student activities. Lisa?
So I was speaking to my husband this morning, who was in a prone position as I was putting on my shoes. He said, sleepily, "Honey, I know you'll do fine." And I said, even if theologically unsound, because we had had an argument the night before about a point in this talk, and he said, "Hey, isn't that what Sunstone's all about?" So, toward a theology of desire, I have two epigraphs to this paper. The first is from The Wasteland. April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. And the second is from Alma. "But behold, if you will awake and arouse your faculties, even to an experiment upon my words, and exercise a particle of faith, yea, even if ye can no more than desire to believe, let this desire work in you, even until ye believe in a manner that ye can give place to a portion of my words." I invented the title of this talk, Toward a Theology of Desire, long before I actually wrote anything to go with it. So I've had a while to meditate upon it and to imagine what a theology of desire might be. I've been thinking hard about the ideas of desire recently and wrote a sustained meditation upon one aspect of desire, its economies or circuits of exchange, in a paper that I read at the last symposium. In the act of writing that paper, I wrote one sentence that I didn't end up reading, but which has stayed in my mind since. Women must learn to speak their own desire in terms that they themselves invent. In these remarks, I will talk about desire in somewhat abstract terms at first, because I think it's worth considering what desire itself is before we speculate on what women's desire might be, before we begin to specify and modify that abstraction. One thing I've realized is that the idea of desire and that word has been present in my consciousness for a very long time. From the time I began to conceive of myself as an adult, with an adult's meditations upon the relations of grown people toward one another, the relations of people to deity. I'm not sure why this is so, not sure why the word desire has assumed the force of a mantra in my spiritual and material life. As I was preparing these remarks, rehearsing texts that I had long ago left behind, both scriptural and personal, I had the distinct impression that what I was preparing had, in fact, the motive of prayer, which is, I suppose, appropriate to the subject of desire. I want also to examine a couple of texts from the Book of Mormon that begin to illuminate the idea of desire for me by way of imagining what a theology of desire might begin to articulate. And then in what has become the workhorse of feminist rhetorical forms, I will get a little personal, tell in some personal terms what a theology of desire might open to me as a woman situated in that most precarious of positions on the margins of belief. Before I launch into the Book of Mormon, I want to read the epigraphs to these remarks and also to speculate generally about desire and its forms and functions. Epigraphs, which are the authorizing sign of someone else's words over my own, have long been a meaningful form for me, since the words as I read and select them have a resonance and potency that unlock the door to the wide world in which I hope my own words will find their place. I chose two scriptural texts, one from the secular scripture of T.S. Eliot and one from the Book of Mormon. It pleases me to put these two texts into conjunction, the Mormon text of intellectual ill repute, along a text with as impeccable and snooty an intellectual pedigree as Eliot's The Wasteland. Let me read the words from The Wasteland again. "April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain." Many of you will know that poem, perhaps remembering it with dread. These lines have had a particular power for me, the conjunction of memory and desire, which in the context of Eliot's poem is as painful to the speaker, rising out of the figures of life, the lilacs out of the dead land, the dull roots stirred with spring rain. The conjunction of these elements, memory and desire, also suggests that the conditions for memory, which of necessity imply that which is past, which is absent and no longer available, are also the same conditions in which desire arises. Desire is that condition in which that which is absent or unavailable in the moment of desiring is precisely its object. Thus, desire, like memory, is a condition predicated upon absence. Like Eliot, Alma, too, makes use of the figures of life in his discourse upon faith, using the metaphor of the seed. I'm going to read out of the Book of Mormon for this one. Behold, if you will awake and arouse your faculties even to an experiment upon my words, and exercise a particle of faith, yea, even if ye can no more than desire to believe, let this desire work in you, even until ye believe in a manner that can give that ye can give place for a portion of my words. Now we will compare the word unto a seed. I remember first reading these words when I was quite young and being disturbed by them, and indeed by Alma's whole construction of the pathway to spiritual knowledge. First desire, then faith or belief, finally knowledge. If knowledge is predicated upon desire, if one has a disposition to believing a thing is true in the first place, isn't that tainted knowledge? How would one know a thing were true if one wanted it to be true? How would one discern between a truth and one's own desire for a thing to be true? In retrospect, I think that my objections to the premises of Alma's argument are quite valid, yet this passage speaks to me in a way that it once did not. For here Alma is making space for the question of what the believer wants, what she desires, and allowing that the disposition of the seeker is crucial to the moment of knowledge. That is, the seeker must want to believe before knowledge is available. Put one way, the experimenter upon Alma's word must not create a hostile environment for the seed of faith. This seems a reasonable formulation of the path to knowledge, one that does not undermine in any way the primacy of the moment of truth over the phenomenon of personal desire. But if you look at this passage at all askew, which is a position in which I often find myself, I admit, the desiring subject begins to have a great deal of power. The seeker's desire provides the life or death of the fragile seed of faith. To end this small dissertation upon these passages, I will also note that for both epigraphs, desire both provokes and is provoked by the figures of life, figures of material life, life which is, moreover, itself metaphorically about the beginnings of bodily life, the seed, the fruit. I've spoken up until now about desire only in common terms, but I'd like to begin to specify this term. As we know, this word has many connotations, many associations with and specific to the sexual. I want to set this aside for the moment, but just for the moment. I'd like to first consider desire in more philosophical terms. As I stated above, perhaps the first principle in understanding desire is that desire is a function of the condition of lack. We must lack something before we can desire it. Thus, unlike a more positivist theology, which is interested in confirming the truthfulness of things, a theology of desire would be interested in investigating conditions of absence and of lack, in finding out about hunger and emptiness, the conditions which produce desire. Such an investigation would not only define the conditions of desire, but would also affirm those conditions. It may seem remarkable to affirm such things as lack, as hunger and emptiness. Okay. Or even to want to affirm desire itself if it is produced by such things. After all, desire does not answer hunger or lack. It compounds them and articulates them. But in that articulation, I find an important reason for affirmation. A theology, like institutional Mormonism's, that wants to affirm the truthfulness of its doctrines to the exclusion of other competitive doctrines, is interested in asserting a kind of plenitude in the here and now. We may not be living in the perfect day, but these are the last days, as close as you can get to the perfect day, and we are filled with the fruits of knowledge. But in another take on this world, we all live in a condition of lack. All desire things we do not have and further have no means of getting. None of us can even articulate what it is that we most deeply want. In speculating on a theology of desire, the desideratum becomes not an affirmation of what is known, but an articulation of what is not known, what is rarely, if ever, spoken, the object of our deepest desires. This suggests to me a second principle in understanding desire, that desire itself, produced by lack, cannot be fully spoken or fully heard. What we speak as desire is fragmentary. The words we have to speak our desire can be at play around that desire, but can never fully articulate it. This is so partly because language itself is never fully referential. It is its own system, and the deep rules of that system prevent its ever representing what it is we want. If you remember times when you tried to speak whatever it was you wanted and then failed utterly, you will know what I mean. The problem of language is compounded by the phenomenon that our thoughts themselves operate through the systems of language, and thus are subject to the same deep rules. Thus, even to ourselves, we are unable to fully articulate our desires. Much of Christian theology has been devoted to the problem of language and its failures to represent the life of the Spirit. Paul tells us that he knew a man in Christ who was, quote, caught up to the third heaven. And he tells us how that he was caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words which it is not lawful for man to utter, as in 2 Corinthians. Here, language is not only inadequate, it is unlawful, an imperfect vessel for expressing the ineffable. Spiritual desire, the desire for interaction with the divine and its objects, thus suffers from the same inexpressibility of all desire, only multiplied. Our inability to express desire does not alter the fact of its existing in the social world, the world of language and communication. This is the third principle for understanding desire, that all desire is mediated, that is, all desire occurs by means of an intervening agency. René Girard talks about this as the triangulation of desire. Up until now, we have looked at desire as if it were a simple matter of a lack which predicates a want which assumes an object. But there's a middle term between desire and its object, the mediating agency. Girard reads novels to show this, that a man does not desire a woman until he sees that she is desirable, that is, that other men want her. This is a clever concept, and it complicates our map of desire. Before, there was something like a straight shot from lack to desire to object, perhaps a barrier or two in there. Now there's a circuit from lack to desire, but then where do we go? To the desire of others. So the path of our own desire involves reading the desires of others. Language itself complicates the picture further, since it as well acts as a mediating agency through which desire is filtered. Small wonder, then, that our own desires are all but indecipherable to ourselves. I want to come back to my sentence. Women must learn to speak their own desire in terms that they themselves invent. This does not seem such a simple matter anymore. Speaking one's own desire becomes fraught with difficulty, and as in the conundrum presented by Alma, where knowledge and the will to knowledge become indistinguishable, here desire, what you want, what others want for themselves, what others want you to want, what you want because others want you to want it. Well, it becomes a fine mess, and one out of which it is impossible to extricate oneself, because this network of desires is the medium in which we live, love, work, struggle, suffer, and enjoy. But only sustained meditation on and the play of language around the forms and functions of desires can help us move toward understanding. I want to come back to women speaking their desires, but first I want to move to the promised Book of Mormon texts. I know you've been looking forward to them. Both of these texts have been important to me for a long time, and I find their moment is undiminished for me. I first found these passages when I was a gospel doctrine teacher about 6 years ago. The first passage is in 3 Nephi, chapter 28. Perhaps you remember it. This is just before Jesus ascends to heaven, just after he has finished teaching the Nephites, after the children have spoken marvelous things. This is where he asks his disciples what it is that they want. I want to read this passage because even after all the sophisticated texts that I have read and studied and interpreted, this one still moves me. Okay, here we are. And it came to pass when Jesus had said these words, he spake unto his disciples one by one, saying unto them, What is it that ye desire of me after I am gone to the Father? And they all spake, save it were three, saying, We desire that after we have lived unto the age of man, that our ministry, wherein thou hast called us, may have an end, that we may speedily come unto thee in thy kingdom. And he said unto them, Blessed are ye, because ye desired this thing of me. Therefore, after that ye are 72 years old, ye shall come unto me in my kingdom, and with me ye shall find rest. And when he had spoken unto them, he turned himself unto the three, and said unto them, What will ye that I should do unto you when I am gone unto the Father? And they sorrowed in their hearts, for they durst not speak unto him the thing which they desired. And he said unto them, Behold, I know your thoughts. And ye have desired the thing which John, my beloved, who was with me in my ministry, before that I was lifted up by the Jews, desired of me. Therefore more blessed are ye, for ye shall never taste of death, but ye shall live to behold all the doings of the Father unto the children of men, even until all things shall be fulfilled according to the will of the Father, when I shall come unto my glory with the powers of heaven. And ye shall never endure the pains of death, but when I shall come in my glory, ye shall be changed in the twinkling of an eye from mortality to immortality. And he goes on. Then it says, And it came to pass that when Jesus had spoken these words, he touched every one of them with his finger, save it were the three who were to tarry, and he departed. And behold, the heavens were opened, and they were caught up into heaven, and saw and heard unspeakable things. Now, of course, this is a scriptural account of the origin of one of the more spectacular recurrent folkloric events of our culture, the origin of the three Nephites. I love Third Nephi because of its insistence upon the ineffable. It is outpouring upon outpouring of the love of God upon people who love God. I, as perhaps you are, am moved to imagine a glory so remarkable that it is unspeakable. But there are two moments of unspeakability here. One is the moment of the high heaven, and the other is a very humble and earthly moment. And they sorrowed in their hearts, for they durst not speak unto him the thing which they desired. The postmodern in me wants to amend that sentence, change "they durst not speak" to "the thing in their hearts which was untranslatable, that they could not speak." But in a theology of desire, perhaps it is useful to imagine that daring, courage, might play a part. What is so moving to me here is that their desire, in that most deep lack from which all desire issues, was unspeakable because they dared not speak it, even before the Lord, the very figure of transparent love. But he reads their desire and articulates it where they can or will not. At the moment of their deepest desire, courage and daring failed them. And as is most appropriate in a text which embraces the ineffable, the Lord steps in to bridge the gap. The other Book of Mormon text is also about ineffability, but it is one which is also a tale of articulation, of telling. This text comes from Alma chapter 22. It comes after the remarkable tales of Ammon converting King Lamoni, where the entire household was struck dumb, a moment of inarticulateness in the extreme. In a sort of textual meanwhile, the book turns to Aaron, Ammon's brother, who comes upon the father of King Lamoni, who is himself a king. After having preached and expounded the gospel to the father of King Lamoni, the king asks, here we are, "And it came to pass that after Aaron had expounded these things unto him, the king said, what shall I do that I may have this eternal life of which thou hast spoken? Yea, what shall I do that I may be born of God, having this wicked spirit rooted out of my breast, and receive his spirit, that I may be filled with joy, that I may not be cast off at the last day? Behold, said he, I will give up all that I possess. Yea, I will forsake my kingdom, that I may receive this great joy. But Aaron said unto him, if thou desirest this thing, if thou wilt bow down before God, yea, if thou wilt repent of all thy sins, and wilt bow down before God, and call on his name in faith, believing that ye shall receive, then shalt thou receive the hope which thou desirest. And it came to pass that when Aaron had said these words, the king did bow down before the Lord upon his knees. Yea, even he did prostrate himself upon the earth and cried mightily, saying, O God, Aaron hath told me that there is a God. And if there is a God, and if thou art God, wilt thou make thyself known unto me, and I will give away all my sins to know thee, that I may be raised from the dead and be saved at the last day. And now when the king had said these words, he was struck as if he were dead. Here the king demonstrates both the power and the difficulty of the act of articulating that which we desire. I do not read the king's prostration as a warning to those who try to make the inarticulate soul speak, except perhaps in this sense, that the effort itself is arduous in the extreme. What to me is most moving is the sense that this heartfelt speech shows us that there is a cost as well associated with the articulating of one's deepest, most naked desire. The king knows that it will cost him much, all his sins, to know God. Perhaps it is worth at this point trying to decide what it is that a theology of desire replaces and stands in contrast with, what other kind of theology it is that a theology of desire might supplement. I have meditated upon this significantly because it was difficult for me to articulate exactly what it is in our contemporary and historical theologies that dissatisfies me, what gap it is that a theology of desire seems to fill or begin to fulfill. I came upon a scripture in the Doctrine and Covenants that began to give me an answer. It is in section 18, verse 38. And by their desires and their works, ye shall know them. Now, the version of this idea that I was most familiar with says, by their fruits ye shall know them, which is a metaphorical extension of by their works. But this suggests that we are known, and we know not only by works, by the concrete, demonstrable act, but by desire, something certainly intangible, inarticulate, and almost unknowable. This is a conundrum indeed, but a useful one. It yields up a fruitful pairing. A theology of works might focus on what can be demonstrated or proven. We prove ourselves by what we do. The fruits of our beliefs are what prove us to each other and to our God. I like to think of this as a theology of truth-telling, our works, the works of our beliefs, the fruits of our doctrine. These are what tell out the truth, a truth which bears testimony of God, his power and glory. But a theology of desire which affirms the unproven, the unspoken, the nascent, the seed before it is fruit, this is a different matter altogether. A wonderful, although quite irreligious man once said to me, "What's the point of a God if he doesn't read the heart?" What point indeed? The pair of stories I read from the Book of Mormon helps me to see the value in reading God as a God who values desire. Jesus reads the hearts of the three Nephites and recognizes their deepest desires. And the father of King Lamoni speaks in an inelegant, almost asyntactic rush of words, forcing into words that which can only begin to be spoken. That effort for me is the very heart of an affirming theology of desire. Ironically, while works seem to be about making something material and concrete, and thus to be about materiality, and while desire seems to be concerned with what's absent, longed for, and thus about perhaps the spiritual, I began by saying that desire has strong associations with the sexual and thus with the body. If we extend our analysis, we can see that works also, though they represent the act of making something concrete, become associated with the telling out of truth and thus with the spiritual. Desire's association with the sexual leads us to understand that often what is longed for is the flesh. It seems crucial to me that we understand this point, for of the two terms in a theology of truth-telling, works will be preferred to desire. Understanding the associations of desire with the body and with sex helps us to understand why the prevailing theology of truth-telling mostly ignores the term of desire. For our theology has mixed emotions about the body. There is a good body and a bad body. The good body is the one that brings forth children, can make covenants, disciplines its appetites. The bad body's desires rage forth, make all sorts of unpredictable choices, has sexual longings that threaten to burst the bounds which the Lord has dictated. If we look at the way our LDS scriptures index one theme, the trust not in the arm of the flesh theme, we can understand something about the way that we feel about the body, the bad body. I was amazed when I looked at the scriptures that were in this under this topic in the topical guide. In 2 Chronicles, with him is an arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord's. In Psalms, some trust in chariots, but we will remember the name of the Lord. I will not trust in my bow, from Psalms again. Put not your trust in princes. Lean not unto thine own understanding, in Proverbs. He that trusts in his own heart is a fool. Isaiah, they worship the work of their own hands. Jeremiah, trust in man and maketh, someone trusts in man and maketh flesh his arms. In D&C, neither trust in the arm of flesh. You should not have feared man more than God. Yield to the persuasions of men no more, and so forth. Where am I here? Okay, one scripture particularly speaks to this issue and makes an important connection. In Proverbs 28:26, we find, he that trusteth in his own heart is a fool, but whoso walketh wisely, he shall be delivered. Here the connection between one's own desires and the body is made explicit, and neither one is to be trusted. It's important here to recognize that the arm of the flesh is both personal, because it can be located in the agency of the individual, and heavily associated with personal and perhaps sexual desire. Part of what's at stake for me in raising the idea of desire up to our painstaking scrutiny is to suggest how crucial it is that we more fully understand, rather than fear, the nature of desire in general and the nature of our own desires. This, of course, includes bodily desire and sexual desire, and these are perhaps a place to begin to explore. Now, what of the desires of women, which I so blithely asserted must be begin to be spoken in terms which women themselves must invent? Here's where I get a little personal. As I was meditating upon these remarks, the word desire reverberating in my head, the inefficient though poetic circuitry of my brain retrieved many bits of information which I have stored in poems. I want to read to you a couple of my poems by way of narrating my own story of desire. As is consistent with the principles of desire I assembled above, this story will only be as articulate as words will allow, although I hope that the more labored over phrases of my poems will allow for a degree of articulation that more direct language will not permit. Part of what is so painful about speaking about our own desires is that it becomes apparent that what we are about in our lives is often a secret to us. Here's a poem which begins to speak for me what I've always felt to be the dangers of desire. This one is called The Dream Work, which I inexplicably put third instead of first. The Dream Work. The figures have less to do with recovery than with resistance. not going to the garden in October to gather the dry corn stalks, not the flare of lights in the kitchen at 5, not the expected spiders in all the corners after first cold, not the snow line descending nearer the valley or the scarred, crew-cut hills. What we recover every autumn, each withered garden, the same sinking light every year. Each night they seem this familiar, but they resist capture or even clear sight. Looking through the window, steamy from the warm house and the dishwater, waiting for father, seeing only the diffuse headlights turning, looking into the face of a man I loved once, now gradually not his face, but someone else's, this man I knew once, in a silk suit saying, "It's what you want this." Yes, but what is it exactly? Its name transparent and relentless, a current of air or water. His name, he doesn't matter. He's here to ask about desire, what I want. Alone on the late street, him shoving me against the wall saying, "You want this." Fearful I won't escape this desire, or that I will. I'm going to have to talk about pregnancy and stuff here, so anyway. In the midst of my fourth pregnancy, I found myself awash in a sea of sexual desire that seemed to have no single or simple object, but many, a desire that could not or could barely name its object. Well, it was men in general. These were not desires I acted upon, but were in my dream life, and I found myself in a world where sexual desire determined everything. It was disturbing beyond belief, and I feel now that it was an expression of anxiety about my own desire. I was in graduate school trying to earn a PhD, yet I was again pregnant. Poetry was spilling out of me. The man in this poem who comes to talk to me about desire and my fright, terror at his roughness, my own ambiguous response to that roughness, this seems to me to be a very precise image of my own fear of what I wanted. When we are unused to meditation upon what we want, our own desire may appear to be monstrous even to ourselves. Couple that with the messages we may hear that sustain the characterization of women's desire as monstrous, out of control, in need of control, and the specter of the beast seems to loom large. Another poem is explicitly about religious desire, about prayer, and it is called "What to Pray For." Once I folded hands and said the old words, so intimate except in speaking to God, a conversation that turned them into gems, hard and colorless. If now I recall the posture, it is the same motion that causes me to collect words for prayer. The word itself gathers the associations of hours spent on knees, talking to bedsheets and listening for voices, hands clenched in one fist, hearing instead the speech of heartbeat, of breath in and breath out, the stroke of the slow blood swimming back to the left side. At night I might still kneel, hear that wordless reiteration, but always I make words for the things I pray for. The empty spaces on maps, envelopes postmarked Huntsville or Fairbanks, a letter with a ptarmigan feather in it, and the story of the dull bird careening flat into the window of a friend's house. For the flat plains of the mountain, mind open, oxidizing into the colors of copper, and the gathering of water into rivers, the spilling of spring floods. For the opening of doors in summer, the dust accumulating quietly on the piano. For the ripening and rotting of apricots, a night without sleep, a morning too early. For the intelligence of the body, even in decay, fingers that turn the tap in exact calibrations to water the lawn. For the thickening of breast and belly, a name for the coming child, and these words of prayer that sing all night in my veins. At the beginning, I spoke about this talk having the motive of prayer. It reminded me of, this poem reminded me of a section in Moroni that talks about good and evil gifts. And the gist of this passage, I won't read it, is that a gift that is not given with real intent, in other words, that's given grudgingly, is an evil gift and is counted as evil toward the giver. To me, the correlative of that is that the gift that is given with real intent, in other words, the gift that you want to give, In this poem, I realize now that I was in some way demonstrating the power of desire in my life. At the point of that poem's writing, I could not want prayer in its traditional forms. Those forms made prayer a mockery for me. But praise, that became my own form of prayer, because praise of this world, God's creation, was my own desire, is what I wanted to do. If what I can bring willingly to God at this moment is praise of this world, if that is the thing I want to give, it must be judged a good gift. And I celebrate and affirm this desire, declaring my praise a holy act. Thank you.
I take my assignment to respond to Lisa's paper as license for my own inclinations today. Given the topic, I think I can do this. Lisa and I are far too good of friends, and we've talked about this topic far too often for me to pretend to offer an objective response or a critique of what Lisa is saying. I can only say amen and wish that I could have said it as well. Instead, I intend to do what I want here and take her remarks as a place from which to stage my own meditation on the subject of desire. I think back some 10 years to a very crucial juncture in my life. My marriage was in trouble, and my husband and I had been seeing a marriage counselor. I made an appointment to see the counselor alone one day. I took him my dilemma. I found myself not wanting to continue counseling. Instead, I found myself wanting to quit the marriage, and what's more, I found myself wanting to quit my job and to quit going to church. For obvious reasons, I was worried about this impulse to quit. I don't like to see myself as a quitter. I don't like to see myself as a negative person, what my dad would call a bellyacher. To my surprise, the counselor seemed less interested in the negativity of my wishes than in the fact of wishing. He asked me if I'd ever tried doing what I wanted to do. It was a very good question. I had to admit that I couldn't think of a time when what I should do wasn't a higher criteria in making a choice than what I wanted to do. I had always made do with the comfort of having my next step in life approved by someone else, by my parents, by my teachers, by my peers and leaders in the church. I left that session frightened and exhilarated. I was going to articulate my life, if I could, through and not against that deep stratum of desire and wish. What would that mean? Well, ultimately it meant that I did quit my marriage, my job, and for the most part, my church. I remember very well those first few months after my separation. I was curious myself about what I wanted. I was watching myself with fascination. Was I a person who cleaned my house? Did I cook meals? Or was I a slob? Would I wear makeup, jewelry, wild clothes? Could I get my hair permed? I was surprised at how many decisions I had simply referred to my husband or convention within my circle in the church. There were all kinds of trivial questions like that which I tested, but there were bigger questions pressing on me as well. How did I want to relate to my children? How did I want to spend my time? Who was important to me? Was I someone who believed in God, who wanted any place in the church at all? Where would I refer such decisions? Where was a basis for wanting, desiring? I have no answer to those big questions. In fact, I have learned to rely in the past few years not on the big picture at all, but rather on the little picture. After all, small threads can unravel the cloth. Small details make a picture. Paying attention to the details means that I have discovered, first of all, to borrow a phrase, the material world. Recently, I was indexing for Signature Books, one of my employers. Quitting that job did not mean I quit working. In fact, now I have 4 jobs instead of 1 job. Our forthcoming reprint of a collection of essays and sermons by Orson Pratt. I still haven't decided whether I'm more horrified or fascinated by Orson. Certainly by now, he is a well-worn acquaintance. And this recent encounter forged a surprising interconnection for me between my personal, religious, and professional lives that I had never quite made before. In my personal life in the past 10 years, I've discovered my body. I always had a mind. I was a real brain. A nerd, my daughter would say. I always got straight A's, even in grade school, even in graduate school. But I'd given my body little thought, and when I had, I thought only about how fat I was, how ugly I was, How afraid I was when I was out of doors, of snakes, of heights, of thunderstorms. Through a good friend, I started running. I thought it would be a social occasion. I can remember how stunned I was when my friend would simply leave me behind when I got tired. That made me angry, but it kept me running, and it kept me pushing, trying out this new thing, my body. I'll never forget the half marathon when I thought I'd die, but I beat my friend by almost 10 minutes. In recent years, I've taken up bicycling and hiking, sweating so hard that you can't see because of the stinging in your eyes, pushing so hard up a mountain that you're sick all over. Such moments have come to mean more to me than I can tell, and also the ecstasy of running for an hour more, or cycling 100 miles, or sailing down a mountain faster than you dare, or inching onto the crest of a mountain which makes you tremble with fear. In bringing my body together with my mind, I have discovered something which feels as solid and reliable to me as anything in my life. To this conjunction, I refer lots of questions these days. It affects how I think about eating, about dressing, about being with my children, about working, and also about big things like morality and worship. Admittedly, I've learned to do this not through the church, but through my experience and also through my work, which for more years than I'm willing to admit at this point has had to do with working towards a PhD in English literature. Studying literature at the university these days also means studying what is dauntingly called theory, or even more formidable, postmodern theory. The irony, of course, was just at the moment I was deciding in my personal life to refer my decisions through a circuit of desiring which led me to my physical body and the specificities of the material world, I came up against in my professional life exactly the complications Lisa has described in the first movement of her essay. Desire is not something substantial, but is rather predicated on absence itself. Our lives must inescapably be lived through language. But language, as Lisa put it very well, language itself is never fully referential. It is its own system, and the deep rules of that system prevent its ever representing what it is we want. At their most radical extremes, such insights bring us up against insuperable barriers to that which we desire. The circuits of desire, the circuits of language, erect a radical difference which separates these circuits we inhabit from a world. We have only our absence, only our lack. I know such thinking at first glance seems counterintuitive. I mean, if you walk out into the street, you get hit by a car. But the more one considers such arguments, the more compelling, even inexorable, they seem. I firmly believe that a good model for learning is to give oneself first sympathetically to ideas, to inhabit them as a disciple, and the next step is to resist them with as much antagonism as one had formerly given sympathetic assent. The difference between the two experiences can be very instructive. In the case of my postmodern education, I found myself wanting to be a post-postmodern. I wanted to acknowledge such circuits of complication, the inevitable gaps, but I still found myself saying, but come now, there's a real world, and it matters to me. But this, of course, is where the model Lisa sketched from the Book of Mormon really complicates things. Wanting something to be true becomes a first step towards knowledge, something which seems true beyond just my wanting it to be so. At any rate, my critical work has found its niche trying to find a way to talk about the real world in fiction after acknowledging all the complications. And I have aligned my own work with what a critic I admire a lot, Jane Gallup, has called thinking through the body. I sometimes wonder if my critical bias doesn't amount at its base to my love of cycling and running and what it has meant in my recent years, transforming itself into a huge, important-sounding abstraction. At any rate, I believe that those circuits of language and desire Lisa has been talking about need to be rooted through talk about the body, and that ultimately, of course, means talking, as she said, about biology and sex. Human bodies are gendered, if sometimes gendered very ambiguously. However fraught the notion of the subject has become, however complicated theorizing about gender, that's still the place to begin. I don't intend to go into all the esoteric details here of why, in interest both of our time and your patience. I only have time to bear my testimony, I guess, to the importance of beginning with messy details of difference between men and women and with the nitty-gritties of the material and biological world. I have never been able to make my Mormon background rejoin these interests, however. In fact, what I have most had to deal with is the anger I felt that I was kept from my body and from the material world, and from valuing desire by my upbringing. Partly, I was just a small-town girl. My father took my brothers fishing, taught them how to play ball. It never occurred to him to have me snag the mitt and for us to go outside together. And the only glance I got at my body from my parents was that embarrassing moment when I finally asked my mother about menstruation so that I could tell my girlfriends at school that I, too, had finally had the talk with my mother. But I also remember all of those talks about chastity and short skirts and sleeveless blouses and protecting the priesthood I had heard at church. And I remember the girls making cookies while the boys climbed and backpacked and fished in the Tetons. And I feel angry at the church. I still feel angry when I see many of the same things still happening to my daughter. How could this be true of a religion which makes so much of being a material religion and makes so much of getting and having and keeping bodies? I understood something which hadn't quite occurred to me before when I was industriously indexing Orson's essay entitled, quite appropriately, The Absurdities of Immaterialism. If Lisa's mantra has become desire, material was certainly Orson's. Every material, he repeats and repeats and repeats and repeats. Look it up in the index, you'll see. Reading Orson this time, I realized that Mormonism's insistence on material and the absurdities of immaterialism need have nothing to do with this real fleshly body. In his essay, Pratt ridicules Charles Darwin because he believed that, quote, ideas are material things. They are contractions, motions, or configurations of the fibers of the organs of sense. In other words, he thought Darwin was crazy because he thought thinking had something to do with the brain. Pratt confidently inserts, but we believe, and this is really interesting, but we believe that the power of thinking, and I think we really do believe this, we believe that the power of thinking is not the result of a brain organization, but the original property of that substance called spirit or mind, which can exist independently of a brain organization and entirely separate and apart from the body. Or in another place, he says it this way, the substance of the deity, nor no other intelligent substance, is dependent on the contractions, motions, or configurations of organical fibers for its actions. Mind, thinking, desiring, these are separate from the body, from the organism, from biology. The terms of Mormon cosmology and theology here seem spun out of a 19th century rhetorical and figural vocabulary. Levine, in his book Darwin and the Novelists, sketches a basic contrast between the rhetoric of 18th and 19th century science on the basis of its preferred figures and objects of study. The preoccupation of 18th century science was astronomy, the predominant figural motif mechanical. The preoccupation of 19th century science was biology, with its resulting organic figures. 19th century Victorian thought can only be understood as burdened by the challenges to family, society, religion, and history made by biological thinking, by giving up on separating thought and desire from the body through which it is articulated. Perhaps I've been unable to rejoin my desires to my church because Mormonism was pitched at its foundings with its eyes to the heaven and to the 18th century in some sense, and its back placed firmly against the, quote, absurdities of Darwin's biology. Perhaps we need to engage more directly what even the Victorians couldn't avoid. I've been reading quite a bit lately about 19th century science because of my own work on the English novelist George Eliot. Eliot was an incredibly learned woman. Before her career began as a novelist, she had translated Strauss's Life of Jesus and Feuerbach's Essence of Christianity, which means she knew quite a lot about beginnings of higher criticism of the Bible. She was close friends with social evolutionist Herbert Spencer and lived with George Henry Lewis, who, among other things, wrote on biology and human physiology. He and Eliot argued on a regular basis with Spencer and read Darwin's Origin of the Species hot off the press. My dissertation takes its title from an early piece Eliot wrote about two nymphs, which is entitled appropriately enough for our purposes here, A Little Fable with a Great Moral. In the fable, the life of each of these two nymphs is tied to the life of a tree, and both spend their lives looking into a lake from its banks. One of these nymphs, Idiona, looks very near to the bank and sees only her face in the lake. As a result, all she sees is her own aging and This makes her increasingly upset, as you might imagine. And finally, she dies when her tree dies. All she sees is her own body. Her whole life consists in narcissistic admiration of her body. Her life is totally constrained by biology. The other nymph, Hyeria, looks out farther into the lake. She's not at all concerned about personal, you know, selfish things like Idione is. She sees the stars and moon reflected there. She dreams of living on the star, looking down on the earth. She notices a haze that sometimes clouds her view of the star, but decides finally that it only makes the stars more beautiful. But as it turns out, the haze has come about because men have come into the area and have been cutting down the trees. One day they cut down her tree, and she dies. Her problems then turn out to be the inverse of Idione's. If Idione looks too near, Hyeria looks too far and finds her comfort in the transcendence and beauty of the heavens. But the point of the story is that her beautiful view does not let her escape from the consequences of living in the real material historical world. She dies from that world, whatever her dreams of the stars. I suppose my point is clear too. I agree with Eliot about the potential limitations and liabilities of the view too near. We have learned, as Lisa pointed out, only too well from our Christian heritage of the evils and limitations of the flesh. Feminists, too, argue interminably about the dangers of thinking through the body. What we must learn is the disabilities which follow from looking too far, from staring at the stars, or, to go back to Pratt's language, from disjoining our talk about the material from the organic, from the real historical world. Somehow we have to learn to do what Eliot's fable implicitly recommends. Look somewhere in the middle. Position ourselves to somehow view the world in a more productive and less dangerous way. For me, this means learning to articulate my life, my worship, through my desires, and through my body, however complicated those circuits.